Please be seated. Meaningless. Meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. I have seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. For the wise, like the fool, will not be long remembered. The days have already come when both have been forgotten. Like the fool, the wise too must die. So I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Surely the fate of human beings is like that of the animals. The same fate awaits them both. As one dies, so dies the other. All have the same breath. Humans have no advantage over animals. Everything is meaningless. Again, I looked and saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. Power was on the side of the oppressors, and they have no comforter. And I declared that the dead who had already died are happier than the living who are still alive. For who knows what is good for a person in life? During the few and meaningless days they pass through like a shadow. Who can tell them what will happen under the sun after they're gone? In this meaningless life of mine, I have seen both of these, the righteous perishing in their righteousness and the wicked living long in their wickedness. There's something else meaningless that occurs on earth. The righteous who get what the wicked deserve and the wicked who get what the righteous deserve. This too, I say, is meaningless. So I reflected on this and concluded that the righteous and the wise and what they do, they're in God's hands, but no one knows whether love or hate awaits them. I have seen something else under the sun. The race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor does food come to the wise, or wealth to the brilliant, or favor to the learned. But time and chance happen to them all. Moreover, no one knows when their hour will come, as fish are caught in a cruel net or birds taken in a snare, so people are trapped by evil times that fall unexpectedly upon them. Meaningless. Meaningless, says the teacher. Everything is meaningless. So who is this teacher? Is he a member of the New Atheist Society? I mean, it sounds a lot like the words of atheist Richard Dawkins in his book, The God Delusion, when he says the universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Or is this the teaching of a cynic's creed, captured in the words of Chicago journalist Mike Royko? Show me somebody who's always smiling, always cheerful, always optimistic, and I will show you somebody who hasn't the faintest idea what the heck is really going on. Where in the world do these words of the teacher come from? Why, they come from the Bible. I mean, this is it. This is the message of the book of Ecclesiastes. Not the whole of it, mind you, but a major part of it. So what are we to make of it? These perplexing words. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Everything is meaningless. I mean, these words provide the bookends of the book, put at the beginning and at the end of the teacher's teaching. Is that really true? Is that really what the Bible teaches? What in the world is going on here in this book called Ecclesiastes? I mean, there's nothing quite like it in the rest of the Bible, and some have questioned whether these words really belong in the Bible at all. So this morning, we begin 3 weeks in which we try to make sense of a book that says the world is senseless. What does the teacher mean when he says that everything is meaningless? Now, it's true that at the very end of the book, the message of this teacher is summed up by the narrator to give the book a very orthodox ending. Chapter 12, verse 13, now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the duty of all mankind. Okay, that sounds good, but that only comes at the end. And because it only comes at the end, the writer intends that we wrestle with a lot of stuff we may not like before we are ready to grasp that truth. And that same narrator not only says that this teacher was wise, but also that what he wrote was upright and true. So how can all this stuff about meaninglessness be true? So I call the message of this book perplexing, which may be one of the reasons why I've been preaching for 35 years, and I am only now gathering the courage to expound this book, even if only in an abbreviated way. And I've come to the conclusion that this book is meant to be perplexing. It is designed to provoke us, to provoke us into thinking deeply about life in this world. The narrator says as much in chapter 12, verse 11, the words of the wise are like goads. Their collected sayings are like firmly embedded nails. A goad, if you don't know, is a spiked stick used to drive cattle. It spurs them on. It prods them to go where they are not inclined to go. And that's what this book does. It provokes us. It's designed to make us feel uncomfortable. It can be exasperating, ruffling our feathers, unsettling our unexamined assumptions. And that's why some people like the book. And it's why other people don't. For it forces us to come face to face with some very tough questions, especially what real significance can our lives have in this life in the light of the certainty of our own death? I mean, who wants to think about death? Death is rarely the subject of polite conversation, and it's not something we want to talk about even to ourselves. The 17th century mathematician and philosopher Blaise Pascal observed it in his day. He says, as men have not been able to cure death, misery, or ignorance, they have taken to not thinking about them so that they might be happy. To avoid such unpleasant subjects, he says, we become obsessed with distraction and diversion. And Pascal said that before the invention of the smartphone, Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, 24-hour cable news, and ESPN. You see, we now live in a culture that bombards us with incessant entertainment. We crave constant amusement. And I just learned this week that the word amusement comes from the old French verb, muser, which meant to stare stupidly. In the 1640s, the word amusement referred to the diversion of attention, especially in deceptive military actions. And in the spiritual battle of our age, amusement is one of the devil's primary tactics. People don't want to think long and hard about the meaning of their lives, especially in the light of the reality of their death. But the teacher of Ecclesiastes forces us to do just and when we do think about our lives in the world, we want to believe that this world has some rational order, don't we? Some predictability that enables us to know what's coming or at least to avoid what we don't want to come to us. If we do this, this will happen. If we act that way, we can expect that result. In other words, we like to believe that our acts have predictable consequences. And the book of Proverbs paints a picture of a world that is just like that, with its general truths based on observable patterns. Proverbs 11:23, the desire of the righteous ends only in good, but the hope of the wicked only in wrath. Or chapter 11, verse 28, those who trust in their riches will fall, but the righteous will thrive like a green leaf. Proverbs 12:11, those who work their land will have abundant food, but those who chase fantasies have no sense. Or Proverbs 12:21, no harm overtakes the righteous, but the wicked have their fill of trouble. You see, that's the way that life is supposed to operate, isn't it? And we can say that usually that is the case. There is quite often a temporal reward for righteous living. Things tend to go better for those who follow the rules. But the teacher of Ecclesiastes seems intent on focusing on all the exceptions. He's been compared to someone trying to teach you how to spell English. You learn simple rules like I comes before E, but then you have words like receive or believe. So you have to add to the rule, I before E except after C. But then what about words like neither or neighbor? The exceptions seem to go on forever. And that's what the teacher of Ecclesiastes seems to be doing. He seems to keep saying, yes, but what about this? What about that? In the meaninglessness of life, this meaningless life of mine, I've seen both of these, the righteous perishing in their righteousness, the wicked living long in their wickedness. I've seen something else under the sun. The race is not to the swift or the battle to the strong, nor does food come to the wise or wealth to the brilliant or favor to the learned, but time and chance happen to them all. I mean, this is disorienting. It's confusing. It doesn't help us to manage our lives. How can you plan for the chance happenings of life when we are trapped by evil times that fall unexpectedly upon us? But I say this, isn't the teacher's view of life realistic? Isn't that the way that life often works? Haven't you seen life work that way? Someone you love gets diagnosed with cancer. Oh no, they didn't smoke. Oh no, they kept good care of themselves. Still happens. Another is fatally struck by a drunk driver. Why did that happen to that person? What did they do to deserve that? Surely they didn't see that coming. Time and chance happened to them all. As one writer put it, if Proverbs is like meteorology, giving us indicators so as to predict certain outcomes, then Ecclesiastes is like the actual weather, fickle, unpredictable in its ability to rant with storms or breathe easy with a mid-morning breeze. In Proverbs, a good man plus God's love and wisdom equals a good life. In Ecclesiastes, a good man plus God's love still dies like the beast or the fool. In Proverbs, wisdom gives us eyes to recognize the storm clouds and do what we need to do in response. In Ecclesiastes, death is a piece of tornado from which no proverbial basement can shelter us. Yes, the teacher of Ecclesiastes is a realist. He looks at the world as it is, just as he sees it. 19 times he says, I saw, or I have seen. For one, I looked and saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. Chapter 6, verse 1, I have seen another evil under the sun. See, this teacher, he is a shrewd observer of life in this world. And he writes from the vantage point of age and experience. He's telling us what he's learned from his lifelong quest to understand the meaning of life. And that's why this book is said to appeal especially to old people like me. Those who've gone around the block a few times, who've seen it all, for certainly the teacher has. In an autobiographical section, which we'll look at next week, he looks back on his own aspirations and desires, and he mulls it all over in his mind. I said to myself, he writes 5 times, I reflected on all this and concluded, he writes. And his conclusion is clear. This, too, is meaningless. This is the real world that we're dealing with, the world as we all see it. This book captures the futility and frustration of a fallen world, something that Paul refers to in that passage we read earlier from Romans chapter 8. It refers to the drudgery of work, the emptiness of foolish pleasure, the mind-numbing tedium of everyday life. I like how one writer put it. Think of Ecclesiastes as the only book of the Bible we know was written on a Monday morning, probably by a philosophy major. And his vision focuses particularly on the human pursuit of knowledge, the human pursuit of wealth, and especially on the reality of death. Certainly a subject that young people rarely, if ever, bring to mind. And the teacher's realism, it cautions us against any trite, superficial formulas and answers to life, which evangelical Christians are sometimes known for. You know, the kind of Sunday school answers for every question, God, Jesus, the Bible. I heard someone just the other day on the radio talking about how evangelicals never ask hard questions. Well, Ecclesiastes asks them. Let's face it, life is messy. And that perspective may lead some to a hardened cynicism. But despite his observations, our teacher, he remains a believer. He remains a believer in the goodness of God. For his realism also includes glimpses of light and hope in those passages that are scattered throughout the book that speak of the God-given joys in this life that we have a duty to receive and to appreciate. And these joys serve as pointers to something bigger, something beyond that we dare not neglect. But that's getting ahead of ourselves. Now, I confess that it's sometimes hard to grasp exactly what this teacher is trying to teach. This book is hard to place in any one literary form. It contains prose narrative, but also poetry, proverbs, parables. It doesn't follow a logical progression. It seems repetitive and even contradictory. It's simply not tidy. It sometimes comes across as a kind of riddle. Questions rather than answers account for much of the book. But isn't its very literary form a part of its message? For if it's about meaning, the meaning of human life in this world, why should we expect it to be clear and simple, easy to understand? For life is not like that, not at all. And in this way, Ecclesiastes has a lot in common with the book of Job. Job is very personal. Ecclesiastes is more philosophical. But they both point to deep questions about life in this world, and neither one gives us easy answers. So before we jump into the book and look more closely at this opening section, we must first ask, who is this teacher? The Hebrew word translated teacher or preacher is the word koheles, koheles. And in some commentaries, that Hebrew word is how they refer to him. The word koheles comes from the Hebrew verb kahal, which means to gather. So a koheles is presumed to be someone who is set over the gathering, the congregation of the people, and in this Jewish context, that would often have been a teacher or a preacher of some sort. The title of the book, Ecclesiastes, comes from the Greek translation of that Hebrew term. And you can see the same connection in Greek. The Ecclesiastes is the one who stands over the ecclesia, that is, the gathered community. And it's the same word that's used of the church. So who is Koheleth, this Ecclesiastes, the teacher or preacher? He is not named, but he's described in verse 1 as son of David, king in Jerusalem. Traditionally, it's assumed that this is a reference to King Solomon, who was well known for his wisdom. And much of what we see in chapter 2 about the pursuit of wisdom and wealth and pleasure mirrors Solomon's own life. The teacher may have been Solomon, but that identification has been questioned because a number of things the teacher says would seem odd coming from the mouth of Solomon. And it's commonly argued that the teacher may have been a literary figure created in the guise of Solomon to make a point. Who else would have had the immense wisdom, wealth, and power to be in a position to make judgments about the emptiness of human wisdom, wealth, and power? So the teacher could have been Solomon, but in the end, our understanding of the book doesn't depend on that identification. As J.I. Packer writes, the sermon is certainly Solomonic in the sense that it teaches lessons which Solomon had unique opportunities to learn. So after this rather long introduction to the book, I want us to actually dig into it and look at what has been called its thematic prelude, found in chapter 1, verses 1 to 11. So turn with me now to Ecclesiastes chapter 1. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What do people gain from all their labors at which they toil under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. So immediately here, we encounter two key expressions for understanding the book. The first is the word meaningless. And that word saturates the book. It occurs in some form 38 times in this book. Now, meaningless is the NIV translation for the Hebrew word havel, havel. And that word is so important in this book. I actually want you to learn it. So I want you to repeat after me, havel. Okay? Havel. Havel, okay. It's written there in your sermon outline. Havel. It's so important. What does Havel mean? Well, in a sense, that's what the whole book is about. The teacher wants us actually to feel what this word means as we travel with him in his reflective journey. Now, in its concrete sense, found elsewhere in the Bible, Havel refers to breath, breeze, mist, vapor. Psalm 144, verse 3. Lord, what are human beings that you care for them, mere mortals that you think of them? They are like a breath, a hevel. Their days are like a fleeting shadow. Psalm 39, 5. You've made my days a mere handbreadth. The span of my years is as nothing before you. Everyone is but a breath, a hevel, even those who seem secure. Proverbs 21, 6. A fortune made by a lying tongue is a fleeting vapor, a havel, and a deadly snare. So in its concrete sense, it means breath, breeze, mist, vapor. And then in its metaphorical sense, havel reverses to something that is insubstantial, something that is fleeting. It's often used of worthless idols. So something that is havel is elusive, it's ephemeral. It's like a cloud of steam that comes from a hot breath on a frosty morning. Now, 8 times in the book, Havel is compared to chasing after the wind. What does that look like? You see, the teacher is saying that life in this fallen world is impossible to grab hold of. It is enigmatic. It doesn't make sense. It seems so pointless, so futile. Now, some object to the NIV translation of the Havel as meaningless, because that seems too definitive, too final. And in the end, we'll see that that's not all there is to say. But surely that's the way it seems, meaningless. How can it be otherwise when we take a good, long, hard look at the fleeting nature of our lives? We are here today and gone tomorrow. And that's why it's been said, inside of every old person, there is a young person wondering, what happened? Where did it all go? And so the book of Ecclesiastes is a meditation on what it means for our lives to be like a whisper spoken in the wind, here one minute, carried away forever the next. Meaningless may be too strong a translation for Havel, simply because, as we'll see as we proceed in the book, the teacher is no nihilist. He's not in total despair with no conception of good and evil. No, he will talk about some things being better than others, which requires some sense of meaning. And ultimately, he will talk about the judgment of God, which gives everything meaning. But his emphasis is on what life looks like under the sun. And this is the second key expression in the book. It occurs 29 times. Just look around, he seems to be saying. What do you see? In one sense, under the sun is limitless in its scope. It encompasses everything, everywhere the sun shines. But in another sense, the phrase is limiting in its perspective. You see, the teacher's focus is on the visible. It's on the tangible. What is knowable through our senses as we look around at the world. What exists under the sun. And you know, this is why Ecclesiastes seems so applicable to our modern world. For that seems to be the view of life that dominates our culture. We call it secularism, don't we? A word which comes from the Latin secularum, which means of this age. The word under the sun, the world under the sun, appears to be a world where God seems absent. Look at life around you. Really look at it. And what do you see under the sun? That is what the teacher is doing. And the book begins in verse 3 with a central programmatic question. What do people gain from all their labors at which they toil under the sun? In other words, when all is said and done, and I reach the end of my 70, or by the current actuarial table, my 74, what will be left? What impact will my life have had? What sort of legacy will I leave behind? And as he looks at life under the sun, what does he see? It will all come to nothing. Verse 4, generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. Compared to the timeless stability of this earth, our lives are just blips on the screen. And this, of course, was written before the emergence of geological theories that measure time in millions and even billions of years. What lasting significance could any of our brief lives have in the light of the numberless millennia of the earth? From looking at the earth, he sees the same pattern in the other basic elements of our cosmos, the sun, the wind, and the sea. Verse 5, the sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south, it turns to the north, round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. Things come and go, and then come around again in the endless, repetitive cycle that never seems to go anywhere. So why should we think that our measly little lives should be any different? Why bother? Why keep exerting ourselves tediously on the treadmill of our existence? I think of that famous figure of Sisymus of Greek mythology, who was condemned to an eternity of rolling a boulder up a hill, only to see it roll back down again, and he was to do it over and over and over again. What's the point of it all? Do you ever feel that way? You clean the kitchen, you wash the clothes. It all just gets dirty again. Never ends. Day after day, you fight the traffic, get to work. You wonder what it's all for. What does it accomplish? Will your tiny little contribution to the workings of the massive bureaucracy of the U.S. government or to our gross national product, will it be any more than a drop in the ocean? All things are wearisome, more than one can say. Verse 8, the eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear of its fill of hearing. In other words, nothing ever satisfies. There's always one more YouTube video to watch, one more championship game to attend to, one more hit song to put on your playlist. Our appetites are insatiable. Verse 9, what has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which we can say, look, this is something new? It was here already long ago. It was here before our time. Now, it's not as if the teacher would say, there's nothing new like the internet or the iPhone. We human beings are always coming up with new things. We're almost obsessed with new things. That's what fuels our economy. But are all these new things really all that new? Are they just new ways of seeking to satisfy the same old human longings, the longings for comfort or convenience or community or social status? Those are the same old human aspirations that never seem to change. And we may work hard to achieve something that will make the world a better place. Isn't that what we try to do? And our lives may have made a difference. But in the end, all our labors will pass away and be forgotten. Verse 11, no one remembers the former generations. And even those yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. Do you recognize any of these names? Owen D. Young, Pierre Laval, Hugh S. Johnson, James F. Burns, Mohammed Mossadegh, Harlow Curtis. Do you recognize those names? You should. See, these are all people who were designated Man of the Year by Time magazine during the last 100 years. They were chosen as the person who had the greatest impact in that year of all the persons living on the earth. A famous fleeting, isn't it? You have to ask yourself, what difference is my life going to make in the grand scheme of things? Nothing, nothing at all, he says. No one remembers the former generations. Even those yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. We labor and we toil. We build our sandcastles on the beach. But when the tide comes in, it washes it all away. The life of mortals is like grass, writes the psalmist. They flourish like a flower of the field. The wind blows over it and it's gone. And its place remembers it no more. It's as if the teacher wants us all to experience something of that midlife crisis or that approaching retirement, when you look back on all that you've done and realize it doesn't really amount to that much? How can we ever avoid this conclusion? Our lives are hevel. It's all hevel. A fleeting breath, a vanishing vapor, insubstantial, empty and ephemeral, worthless, without any lasting meaning. Let me pause for a moment. Just let that sink in. So what are we to think of what we just read? How are we to respond to it? Well, let me suggest two responses that these provocative words ought to evoke in us. First, it ought to foster some real honesty. The teacher wants us to think hard about the real world that confronts us every day. And the questions he raises are, if we are honest, questions that we will all ask at some point in our lives. They are questions we must ask if we're truly human. For to be human is to seek meaning for our existence. As one writer said it, of all the biblical books, Koheleth is the one closest to his readers. He says aloud things that everyone else is thinking. The Russian novelist Leo Tolstoy put it this way, my question, that which, at the age of 50, brought me to the verge of suicide, was the simplest of questions lying in the soul of every man, a question with an answer to which one cannot live. It was, what will come of what I am doing today or tomorrow? What will come of my whole life? Why should I live? Why wish for anything or do anything? It can also be expressed thus, is there any meaning in my life that the inevitable death awaiting me does not destroy? You see, this book calls us to be honest about addressing that question. Is there any meaning in my life that the inevitable death awaiting me does not destroy? And there's no place for trite and simplistic answers. He wants us to get honest about the real world, in this real life, in this fallen world. And an honest reflection on that question should elicit a second response from us, and that is humility. This book humbles us. It humbles us because the reflections of the sage in Ecclesiastes unmask the myth of human autonomy and self-sufficiency. This book declares that life has lost the key to itself. We cannot control our lives. We cannot figure it all out. The world doesn't seem to make sense. It remains an enigma. Who can unlock its mystery? In other words, this book drives us to the conclusion that we cannot be like God. And that's humbling. And the project of this preacher is to cut us down to size. He's intent on forcing us to come face to face with our mortality and our finitude. Everything is a breath, fleeting, fleeting. Everything is fleeting. As one writer puts it, that eternal why hangs over our lives. It meets us at every turn. Our fondest hopes are shattered. Why? Where is the sense of it all? And yet we must go on looking for the sense. It's incredible that life should make no sense. Every man who thinks at all believes that there is sense somewhere, if only we could find it. But life has lost the key to itself, he continues. If you want the key, you must go to the locksmith who made the lock. Since you cannot get the key, you must trust the locksmith to open the doors. And you know that applies not just to the unbeliever. No, not even Christians are allowed to grasp all the mysteries of the plan of God. We must simply trust that there is a plan. And that is humbling for us all. So as I close this morning, you know, I really like to race to the end of the book and put on a happy ending and kind of get at the conclusion and we can all wrap it up and be gone. But I don't want to do that because the writer doesn't do that. This book doesn't do that. We have to take a journey with this teacher. And it's a journey we'll continue next week. We must resist easy answers, and we must reflect deeply on the questions that this book raises, for these are the questions that we must all wrestle with. And if you are not a Christian here today, I challenge you to think deeply and honestly about the big questions of this book. Resist the temptation to go back into that world of distraction and amusement. What can give your life meaning in the face of the shortness of our lives and the inevitability of our death? Take this journey with the teacher and face the real world with honesty and humility. And if you're a believer, if you're a Christian here this morning, don't think you won't ask these questions. Because if you haven't already, you will. And you see, going through this book, taking this journey, will brace you to face life in this fallen world and even to face death. It will come with a renewed certainty that the only answer is to be found in the God who created us and who sent his Son to redeem us. So let's pray. Oh Lord, we confess there's something very heavy about this book. It forces us to think hard about hard things. We are used to distraction. We are used to amusement. Our culture doesn't encourage this kind of thinking, this kind of questioning. But Lord, you do. Because you want us to live life authentically. You want us to live life in the light of the truth. And so we need to face what this book presents us with honesty and with humility. So Lord, help us. Help us as we go through this book to capture its deep meaning for us, that we may come to know you better in this mysterious world in which we live. And that's our prayer. In Jesus' name, amen.